This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, April 9th, 2002. I'm Deepa Fernandez at Pacifica Station WBAI in New York. The Israeli military distracts the world's attention as they pull out of two small Palestinian towns. At the same time, the death toll rises in the Palestinian refugee camps of Jenin and Nablus. We'll also hear reaction from Colin Powell's Middle East peace mission. And as California Earth First leaders Judy Barry and Daryl Cherney bring their case against the FBI, the FBI also raids and arrests New York City Palestinian and human rights activists. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. 13 Israeli soldiers died in a booby-trapped building in the occupied city of Jenin in the West Bank today. According to an Israeli military source, the soldiers were searching the camp, reportedly the site of heavy resistance during the 12-day military campaign throughout the West Bank. Has anybody...
Yep. Did you just hear that? I don't know what that was, but that was huge.
How close were you to that?
I would say it looks like there's now flames. I don't know what that is. I would say maybe a couple blocks, three blocks.
That was International Solidarity Movement activist Beth Dowd, now in Nablus. Dowd has seen how the Israeli military picks their terrorist targets.
If somebody walks out on the street, they're going to get shot. I mean, I'll give you an example. Today there was a French journalist, Channel 5, and he was with an ambulance, and he stepped out of the ambulance, and they aimed at him and fired. They shot him in the chest, and luckily he had one of those bulletproof vests on, but it came within like a millimeters of his heart. I mean, they're aiming to kill journalists here, and it doesn't matter who you are.
And Kristen Scher reports from Bethlehem on another type of run-in with the Israeli military.
Today there was a tank and an APC and soldiers standing around, and they grabbed a Palestinian man who was caught out on the street, and they pushed him to the ground, and they took his coat off, and they were going to shoot him, but we just kept walking forward with our hands in the air. There were four of us, and they kept yelling at us to go back, and we didn't. And so after 20 minutes, they let him go. We asked him if he wanted us to walk him home, and he said yes, and that they were going to shoot him because he didn't have his passport with him, which is like the Palestinian ID card. And so we ended up walking him home, which turned out to be a mental hospital. And the doctor there said, "How did you know he was one of ours?" And we said, "We didn't. We just, we walked him home, and this is where he came."
That was Beth Scher reporting from Bethlehem. Most in Britain are hopeful after a second day of IRA members turning in their weapons. Anastasia Kershaw has more.
Britain and Ireland were united in praise today as the IRA promised to embark on its second round of decommissioning in less than a year. Both governments say the move is significant because decommissioning is now a process, not a one-off gesture. While nationalists welcome the move, hardline unionists have dismissed it as a cynical PR stunt ahead of the impending general election. Pushing for loyalist decommissioning is Mark Durkan, leader of the Social Democratic Labour Party, who says loyalists should follow the IRA's example. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Anastasia Kershaw in London.
Yugoslavia is hastily preparing to adopt a law formalizing cooperation with the international criminal tribunals in The Hague after U.S. aid is cut. Liliana Smilovic reports from Belgrade.
Extradition of Yugoslav nationals is illegal under the present Yugoslav constitution, but Belgrade is going to sidestep its constitution by passing an act that will allow its citizens to be sent to The Hague in contravention of the constitution. This is a bitterly divisive issue in a country that has been blamed by the West for 10 years of civil war and bloodshed in the Balkans. The Serbian government, led by Prime Minister Zoran Djindjic, won resounding Western support and sympathy last June when he handed over former President Slobodan Milosevic to The Hague. Washington cut off aid to Yugoslavia following a March 31st congressional deadline on cooperation with The Hague. U.S. assistance is expected to resume once The Hague law is passed in Belgrade and once the indicted Yugoslav nationals are sent off to The Hague. Liliana Smilovic in Belgrade for Free Speech Radio News.
The U.S. Supreme Court has halted a Tennessee execution and will hear answers to their concerns behind closed doors. Hal Humphreys reports from Nashville.
The United States Supreme Court halted the execution of Abu Ali Abdul Rahman yesterday in a very brief order issued just 36 hours before his scheduled lethal injection. The order, which put the brakes on Tennessee's second execution in 42 years, did not explain the court's interest in the case. Abdul Rahman requested a hearing on allegations that prosecutor John Zimmerman withheld evidence of Rahman's mental illness. Supreme Court justices will consider this in private conference on Friday. Procedural rules have kept this complaint out of federal courts until now, mostly due to defense not meeting state-established filing deadlines. Hal Humphreys, Free Speech Radio News, Nashville.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
Israeli Foreign Minister Shimon Peres disputed Palestinian claims of a massacre at a refugee camp in the West Bank town of Jenin. Over 100 Palestinians died in Jenin today, but Peres says Israeli troops faced fierce resistance from Palestinian militants holed up in a small pocket in the Jenin refugee camp. The Palestinian Authority has compared the casualties in Jenin to the massacre by Israeli allied Lebanese Christian militia of hundreds of Palestinians in the Sabra and Shatila refugee camps near Beirut during Israel's 1982 invasion of Lebanon. Free Speech Radio News correspondent Inigo Gilmore was in Jenin alongside the Israeli army and joins us now.
I was in Jenin, or close to the town of Jenin, where Israelis have been bombarding the town. And in particular, the refugee camp adjacent to Jenin. There's been very ferocious fighting there, we understand. The Israelis, I watched Cobra helicopters firing missiles into the camp at buildings and watched the smoke billowing up from underneath. We understand there are at least 150 Palestinians who've been killed. Some Palestinian officials say it could be well into the hundreds, perhaps even 300 or 400. And just today, we learned that at least 13 Israeli soldiers were killed. It seems that they went into a booby-trapped house in the camp and were killed during a series of explosions and possibly came under fire from some Palestinians there. That's the heaviest loss so far for the Israeli army since the start of the conflict, and has obviously raised a lot of alarm.
What news are you actually getting out there of the level of casualties on the Palestinian side? So what you've been telling us, are you getting information? Is that coming out as to other places besides just Jenin?
Well, I managed to get to a village near Jenin and interviewed some men who'd been released by the Israeli army. There were about 90 men there, and they told me stories of bodies piled up in the streets, that some people had been killed when the Israeli army bulldozed their homes. Some of the corpses have just been left ungathered. The ambulances couldn't get near to pick them up. In addition, we're hearing of at least 50 to 60 casualties in the old city of Nablus, where there was also very intense fighting. Prior to that, I was in Ramallah, and there's at least 40 to 50 dead in Ramallah. But a lot of these figures are quite sketchy still, and we're waiting to get a more clarified death toll.
And what about this pullout by the Israeli army of two towns?
Well, it was, I think, very much a symbolic thing. Tul Kaam and Qaqilia are not the most important places for the Israeli army, and they pulled back from them today. But the most important places they're still in, and I think also what we saw today was they actually went into a new town, Dura, near Hebron. So it seems to be mixed signals coming out of the army and from the government over exactly what they're doing. They don't seem to be heeding the calls of President Bush or Colin Powell to pull back, and the international community is growing increasingly frustrated and angry with the Israeli government over this.
What is the situation like now for journalists? It's appearing that it's even tougher from what we're getting at. You were actually in a group that was fired on a few days ago. What's the situation like?
Well, it's still very tense for us. We've had a lot of harassment in the Israeli army. I myself had my passport and press card taken away, and it took some negotiation to get it returned. Cars have continued to be fired on. Journalists have been intimidated. It is a very, very difficult situation to cover at the moment. And despite complaints against the Israeli government, these complaints did not seem to have been acceded to or taken into account, unfortunately.
So where do you see this as going? Is it going to continue for much longer? Do you think Powell's visit will signal more of a withdrawal of Israeli troops?
It doesn't look like it. They've been talking at least 2 or 3 weeks operation. I think that at this stage it looks like it's going to continue. They are saying they will continue for as long as it takes to root out what they call the terrorist infrastructure. It seems rather unclear what that is, but that's what they're saying they're going to do. And I think you'll find that when Colin Powell comes here, there will still be quite large-scale operations continuing. It's going to be interesting to see how that affects his visit.
U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell says he will meet with the besieged Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat later this week and once again called on Israel to halt its offensive against the Palestinians. Powell was speaking in Cairo after meeting with the Egyptian leaders before heading to Spain and Jordan. International condemnation seems to have little impact on Israeli authorities, who say their military campaign against the Palestinians will continue. The Israeli army has also called up fresh reservists in response to an escalating wave of clashes with guerrilla fighters along the border with Lebanon. With more on the international efforts to end the bloodshed, Sputnik Colombe in Paris.
Angry demonstrators greeted U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell on his arrival in the Egyptian capital Cairo today from Jordan, where he was warned by King Abdullah that American credibility was fast becoming extinct. Powell said he would meet Yasser Arafat Thursday and warned that both Israeli and American long-term interests would suffer if the current violence did not end. His comments after meeting with President Hosni Mubarak came in stark contrast to recent statements by President Bush, putting the onus for the current crisis on the Palestinians.
I come with a commitment on the part of President Bush, the American people, and the international community to try to do everything in our power to bring this violence to an end. So we can, as my colleague said, move to a political track. All of us know that we must get to a political track. We must get to political discussions which will lead to the creation of a Palestinian state called Palestine, living side by side in peace with Israel.
Analysts say Powell is caught in the contradictions of U.S. policy. The president himself and key officials in the Pentagon see Israel's actions in large part through the prism of counterterrorism. Anti-Israeli and anti-American demonstrations have become a daily occurrence in many Arab countries, as Arab leaders come under fire for not doing enough to change the course of events. Iraq said today it would suspend oil exports for a month to put pressure on Israel, a move likely to have little impact unless Saudi Arabia and Kuwait follow suit. Egypt's foreign minister, Ahmed Mahar, said he made his country's position clear to his U.S. counterpart.
This is a sort of violence that has to stop. We believe that it is important for the Israelis to stop, as the Secretary said, their incursion or invasion, as I would call it, withdraw from the territories. And I think there should be some sort of observer corps to see that what happened is not repeated.
There's been little change on the ground, though. The entire old city of Nablus is under Israeli control, while the standoff at the Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem is now in its second week. Nearly 2,000 Palestinians have been detained since the offensive began, with widespread allegations of torture. Journalists say their job is increasingly difficult to do, and a French TV cameraman was shot and injured today. The situation in many West Bank towns is described as catastrophic. The International Red Cross says ambulances are being prevented from reaching the wounded and has urged Israel to respect the Geneva Convention. The Israeli response so far to calls for an end to its campaign has only bolstered speculation that Colin Powell did not make Israel his first port of call in order to give Israel a narrow margin of time in which to wind up its operations on the ground. The patience of the UN Security Council is running out. There is talk of resolution fatigue as declaration after declaration gets hammered out in New York and falls on deaf ears in Israel. An unusually strong comment on BBC television earlier today from Britain's UN representative, Jeremy Greenstock.
The Security Council is getting, I think, increasingly intolerant of the continuing Israeli action. That's the mood in the Council at the moment. And the Israelis really do now have to pull back out of the Palestinian territory.
Other European Union members are likely to make the same point to Colin Powell when he arrives in the Spanish capital, Madrid, later today. The ball is clearly in Israel's camp at this point. I'm Sputnik Kilambi reporting for Free Speech Radio News.
It's day two of the jury selection in the long-awaited trial for California Earth First leader Judy Barry and Daryl Cherney versus the FBI and the Oakland Police Department. The lawsuit, which took 11 years to come to trial, challenges the FBI's handling of the 1990 car bomb attack, which severely injured Judy Barry and Daryl Cherney as they drove down an Oakland highway. The suit charges the FBI and Oakland Police Department of violating their basic constitutional rights, false arrest, and conducting a smear campaign characterizing the two environmental activists as terrorists. In the 12 years since the attack, the bombing remains unsolved, and in 1997, Judy Barry died of breast cancer. Kata Mesta has more from the federal courthouse in Oakland.
There was no way in the world that that pipe bomb was our bomb.
Earth First activist Daryl Cherney was in the car with Judy Barry when the pipe bomb exploded.
We were nonviolent activists. We had our nonviolence codes in our backpack. We had the 36 death threats that we had received on us at the time. We were showing them to law enforcement all over, begging for help. No, that was not our bomb. That bomb was designed to kill Judy Barry.
Immediately following the bombing, the FBI accused both Barry and Cherney of transporting the explosives, which blew up Judy Barry's car. Law enforcement arrested the two and pursued no other leads. Prosecutors later refused to press charges, saying the FBI had no evidence to support that claim. Lisa Barry, Judy Barry's daughter, was 9 years old at the time of the bombing. She says hours after the attack, her family home was raided by the FBI.
I just remember coming back and having everything be torn up. I mean, I don't know if you know anything about it, but a lot of things were taken out of our house that were just to show evidence. There were things like nails and duct tape, things that anyone would have in their house and things like that. So our house was completely torn up by the FBI. And at the bottom of this case is that there was someone and a bomb blew up in their car and no one ever found out who did it. I mean, who did it? We don't know. And the FBI or the Oakland Police never had a real investigation. I mean, there was never any real concerted effort to find out who actually did this. I mean, and it's true. My mother did live in fear because someone had tried to put a bomb in her car. Someone put a bomb in her car and it exploded. I mean, you can't, at the bottom of it all, no one ever found out who did it.
Judy Barry organized Northern California Earth First to employ nonviolent direct action to oppose destructive logging practices. Barry insisted there not be any verbal or physical assaults or use of drugs or alcohol during actions, which helped the group appeal to a wider community. She also led the campaign to preserve the Headwaters Forest in Humboldt County. At the time of the bombing, she and Daryl Cherney were touring college campuses promoting Redwood Summer, a series of nonviolent logging protests. Historian Howard Zinn was slated to testify on the FBI's long record of unconstitutional activities directed at people the Bureau considered subversive. Although he was removed from the witness list, Zinn told Free Speech Radio News he would have specifically addressed the FBI's COINTELPRO, or counterintelligence program. Among the FBI's documented tactics during the 60s, 70s, and 80s were illegal breaking and entering, surreptitious communication with employers to make activists lose their jobs, and sending threatening letters.
You know, the record of the FBI and COINTELPRO was so flagrant, you know, that the FBI promised then, after this exposure, that it would not engage in such activities. However, it turned out the FBI continued to do surveillance, harass, and black bag jobs.
Zinn says the Barry trial is especially important after September 11th because it reveals how the government has violated the Constitution it is supposed to uphold.
We're now right in the process of facing governmental actions which diminish the civil liberties of citizens. We're in a situation where the free speech and free association of American citizens is in danger because of an atmosphere of intimidation that has been created since September 11th.
Opening statements for the 8-week trial are expected to begin Wednesday.
Didn't you hear the news about Judy and Daryl, a planted bomb, and the FBI's abuse?
At the Oakland Federal Courthouse for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Kata Mester.
Assassins are running free, about free to say what's on your mind, till you mess with the big money.
This morning, as Pacifica Station WBAI prepared to interview guest Farouk Abdelmouti, the coordinator of the New York-based Palestinian Aid Society, about the unfolding events in the occupied territories, Farouk Mouti received a call from his son in Brooklyn that the FBI had just raided their house.
This morning, after I come to the office here in WBI, the four FBI's come and knock the door of the apartment which we are sharing with Bernard McFaul, is an American, and my son was sleeping in the house. And these people Bernard McFaul opened the door, and after he's coming inside and looking for me and beginning to check the our papers and threat my son and threat Bernard McFaul, including tell him I'm going to throw you from the window.
Muti's son said the FBI did not present a warrant and that they trampled over property and even seized his telephone directory and copied numbers. Muti says the FBI also took issues with posters on his wall. He explains.
Palestinian posters from abroad from our countries, and you see the picture of some of our leader, what is Naif Hawatma, General Secretary of the Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine, and begin to provoke from that issue to Bernard McFaul. He say you are support the Palestinians and the Democratic Front, and provoke, and after beginning to provoke to my son, what is sick and have to take medicine and get him up by force.
Also in New York this morning, four people, including an attorney and a translator for the blind cleric Sheikh Omar Abdul Rahman, were arrested for, as the U.S. Attorney's Office said, providing material support and resources to a radical Egyptian group. The indictment charged that the defendants gave support to the organization known as the Islamic Group through various means, including passing messages regarding the group's activities to and from the Sheikh. The indictment charged the unlawful communications with Abdul Rahman occurred during prison visits and telephone conversations with Lynn Stewart, who was one of Abdul Rahman's lawyers. Ilma Carmago is a human rights lawyer who was notified by Lynn Stewart's colleagues of her arrest early this morning.
The information we have at this moment is that she had been indicted for violating an agreement that she was forced to sign, maintaining in secrecy the events of the case against Sheikh Omar Rahman, and that she had been collaborating with Islamic groups to pass third-party information to these Islamic groups that Sheikh Omar, who is in isolation, was distributing, wanted to pass on to his followers. That information seems to be outrageous. It seems to be a great violation of her rights as to defend this individual, and it's a difficult situation for attorneys who will have now the fear of defending individuals accused of terrorism.
Lynn Stewart has represented political prisoners, civil rights advocates, and has served mainly minority communities in New York City, which she does a great deal of pro bono work for. Her colleagues are extremely worried about both her arrest and the chances of a fair trial. Robert Boyle, her attorney, was scheduled to represent her at her arraignment trial today at 3 p.m. in New York. Last week, courts in two states handed down important rulings for imprisoned Muslim cleric Rabia Haddad and Global Relief, the charity Haddad co-founded in 1992. Haddad has been jailed without charges since December 14, the same day federal officials raided and seized the assets of Global Relief, the nation's second-largest Muslim charity, alleging that the group has ties to terrorism. Since December 14, Haddad has faced three closed hearings, but last week a Detroit federal judge ruled that the media and public had been improperly barred from the hearings. Chris Giovannis reports from the Chicago Independent Media Center.
On April 3rd, advocates for free speech and immigrant rights won an important victory when a U.S. District Court judge in Detroit ruled that it was unconstitutional for the government to bar the press and public from deportation hearings for imprisoned Muslim cleric Rabia Haddad, who was arrested late last year for overstaying his visa. But 2 days later, U.S. District Judge Wayne Anderson ruled in Chicago that the Global Relief Foundation, in which Haddad serves as an officer, could not prevent the government from presenting secret evidence to the judge and keeping that evidence from the charity. Andy Thayer of the Chicago Coalition Against War and Racism.
The problem with secret evidence is you have no opportunity to examine the validity of that evidence. You have no opportunity to face your accuser. You have no opportunity to determine whether or not there is a fair trial being held at all, because it's all done in secret.
The case against Rabia Haddad and Global Relief is believed to be the first in which the government has invoked the USA Patriot Act, including new secrecy provisions civil liberties advocates continue to vigorously oppose. Andy Thayer.
A basic principle of the American court system that people fought and died for was that trials are to be held in public so that the public could examine whether or not the government was on a political vendetta against an individual or an organization or not. And the case of Global Relief Foundation starts a very dangerous, slippery slope for this country's judicial system. If secret proceedings are allowed in this case, then they presumably could be held against any American organization, church, civic, religious, or what have you. And we've seen many times in the history of this country that this government is not above using the judicial system to launch vendettas against organizations with which it politically disagrees, whether we're talking the Black Panther Party, whether we're talking labor unions, whether we're talking anti-war organizations or what have you.
Both Thayer and Clemens have reviewed the public portion of the federal government's alleged evidence against Global Relief and Pastor Haddad. Material, they say, is either trivial, including copies of the group's website pages, or fraught with innuendo that demonstrates no criminal wrongdoing. Why, then, is the government pursuing Pastor Haddad and Global Relief? And why is it keeping its evidence secret? Roger Simmons, lead attorney for Global Relief.
The pattern that has appeared here is one that sort of told to us in the parking lot on promise of anonymity on one of the FBI agents, and that was what the real goal here is, to simply to shut down all Muslim charities that are delivering aid in areas where there is what is called a hotspot somewhere in the world. So if a Muslim charity dares to help out people that have been the victims of, say, ethnic cleansing in Bosnia, or help out in a context where there's been an unpleasant regime in Afghanistan, that Muslim charity itself will be deemed to be a traitor and will be closed down and forever tainted with ugly allegations. It is, I guess you would call it profiling as applied to an unpopular religion. In a country that was founded on numerous creeds and ethnic peoples and religions, it is a dangerous precedent indeed to give someone of one persuasion the power to say others don't believe the way he thinks they should believe and for that reason shut them down.
This case is no longer Rabi Haddad's case or his family. It's going to affect so many others.
Rabi Haddad's wife, Salma al-Rashid.
You don't know, since this has happened to us, we don't know where the line is going to be drawn, affecting them, the civil liberties and the human rights. If they detain somebody for 4 months and, you know, not telling him why he has been detained, then where do you draw the line? How do you deal with it? If they're going to set precedent like that now, then how is it going to be dealt with in the future? It's really dangerous. It's really dangerous.
We were unable to reach the INS for comment on the status of the immigration case against Haddad, al-Rashid, and their children, and the U.S. Attorney's Office in Chicago did not return our calls. Meanwhile, Rabi Haddad remains incarcerated without charges in Chicago's Metropolitan Correctional Center, and INS actions against the family continue, with the next hearing scheduled for tomorrow. That hearing will be held in open court. This is Chris Giovannis of Chicago Indie Media for Free Speech Radio News.
Free Speech Radio News is produced at Pacifica Stations KPFA in Berkeley and WBAI in New York City, and community radio station WMNF in Tampa, Florida. I'm Deepa Fernandez.